I have no power, so I must resort to the tools of education, to writing and speaking.
I think it still hasn't sunk in yet that Edward Said is gone. He will be remembered by many as one of the most articulate advocates for justice for the Palestinians.
The Guard and Reserve in my state are deeply worried. Their recruitment levels are down now. I believe when people come home, they're going to get out.
Lynn, in that same afternoon, sobbed in court, expressed remorse for joining the Taliban, denounced bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and went away to an almost a very sort of touching scene with his family expressing support behind him.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, September 24th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A leading figure in Iraq's governing council died today of wounds suffered in an ambush last week, marking the first time Iraq's violence has claimed the life of a member of the U.S.-appointed administration. Akilah al-Hashimi's death came as a bomb damaged a hotel housing the offices of NBC News, raising fears of attacks against international media. A Somali guard was killed and an NBC sound engineer was slightly wounded in the early morning explosion. Israel has temporarily grounded 27 Air Force pilots who, in an unprecedented protest, condemned airstrikes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip as immoral and refused to fly such missions. The declaration by 27 reserve pilots, including 9 on active duty, was widely criticized in Israel as subversive at a time of war. But it also revived the flagging debate on the ethics of Israel's 3-year war on Palestinian militants. The protests struck a nerve because many Israelis believe their military has higher moral standards than that of their neighbors, and that other countries would have been much more ruthless. The military is also seen as an institution that binds the fractious nation. Israelis get jittery at signs of cracks in the ranks. The Air Force, in particular, is considered key to Israel's survival, and pilots are held in the highest regard. Critics also say such talk gives ammunition to Israel's enemies. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said the rebel pilots would be dealt with swiftly. A leading voice in the struggle for Palestinian rights has been stilled. Edward Said, a renowned Palestinian scholar, literary critic, and author, has died at the age of 67. He succumbed to a battle with leukemia last night at a New York hospital. A bit later in our program, we'll hear from the people who knew Said, acclaimed his works, and grieved the loss. Bush administration officials fanned out over Capitol Hill yesterday, making their case for the president's $87 billion budget request to rebuild war-torn Iraq and Afghanistan. Hearings were held in both the House and the Senate committees charged with appropriating the additional funding. Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, Democrat of Ohio, is a member of the House Foreign Relations and Appropriations Committee, one of the committees hosting a hearing on the president's request. During a conversation today with Peace Watch, we asked her if she's prepared to allocate supplemental funds the president is requesting.
I personally am not prepared to give the president a blank check. And I don't believe the administration's reporting back to Congress on prior appropriated dollars has been full nor forthcoming. We don't even know how the billions and billions of dollars that we appropriated last year have been spent. For example, as I pointed out at the hearing yesterday, one of our soldiers wrote back to us that his whole unit is paying $1 a minute in order to call back to their families here in the United States, people who are in Iraq. And I thought, after the billions that I have voted for, our soldiers are having to pay this kind of money, and their families are having to send them these dollars?
Mm.
Now, we have a moral obligation to try to help to restore order in Iraq. However, I don't think we should be taking American appropriated dollars. I think we should be structuring loan packages based on Iraq's future earnings and draw the world community more broadly into creating more stable conditions in that part of the world. But no blank checks from this member. I think the image of U.S. dollars being shipped over to Iraq on pallets, which is literally what's been happening, and being given out for pensions, for the cost of their security forces, and who knows what else, is a very bad image because it's sort of like the super welfare state. I think that we need to engage the Iraqi people who are an educated people, a literate people, in putting a plan together through a representative governing council on how we transition to a more open economy and, based on their future earnings, then move loan packages forward. The administration hasn't given us the kind of specificity and plan which will give one confidence. In fact, in their testimony this week before our subcommittee, they only presented a budget through next election year, 2004.
Now, Congresswoman Kaptur, as a member of the House Foreign Relations and Appropriations Committee, you have access to the details of these funds and how they will be allocated. Apparently, only a portion of the $87 billion will actually go to rebuild Iraq. Are you familiar with what percentage that is?
The proposal before us was $20 billion of the $87 billion. And even Ambassador Bremer admitted to us there were portions of the administration's proposal over which he had no control. One of my questions as an appropriator is, who does have control? And I was very concerned yesterday and made a point at the beginning of the meeting that we were only given 8 minutes each member of the subcommittee, only 8 minutes to ask questions of two of the most important administration witnesses to appear before Congress. The way I figured it, for an $87 billion package, that means we were given 1 minute for each billion that we had to review. There is no way in heaven that we can make reasoned judgments based on that type of allocation of time in the committee. We can't have follow-up questions. We can't get the detail that we're looking for. This is the largest request for a supplemental in American history. It dwarfs the entire foreign assistance bill for the entire world. The amount of money in this bill equals more than we spend in 1 year on all of our transportation programs for our country, added to all of our education programs, added to NASA, to all of our veterans programs, and all of our housing programs. Think about that.
Yes.
This is a huge request. One of the questions that I asked about why are our soldiers having to pay this money for phone calls, General Abizaid appeared not to even know this was happening. This doesn't build confidence among the members of the committee.
Do you think it was a deliberate attempt to limit the questioning on the part of those officials?
I absolutely do. And one of my questions was, since this money is for rebuilding and much of it will go through the Department of State, why don't we have Secretary Powell before our committee? And why is Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Defense Secretary Wolfowitz not before the committee, since they were the architects of this policy? The answer I was given is, well, there are other committees in Congress that are meeting and other officials will appear. Well, which officials? And how much time will be given? And are those committees the committees that actually have the funding responsibility, which is what our responsibility is? And so we have been literally handcuffed as members of that committee. For many years, I've been in Congress 2 decades now. In prior sessions of Congress, you could have follow-up questions. We were not allowed to do that this time. I waited for a second round of questioning. I was not allowed to question. They're trying to constrict the time that the public gets to review this massive request because they want to slide it through.
Yesterday, in the Senate Appropriations Committee hearing on the president's supplemental budget request for Iraq, Senator Durbin raised the issue of combat and family separation pay. I want to play this clip for you and then ask you for your response afterwards.
All right. We said we're going to raise combat pay to $225 a month and family separation allowance to $250 a month. And we said we'll leave it to the Authorization Committee to decide just what to make in terms of permanent law. We raised those levels, and those levels that we raised them to will expire on October 1st. There is pending an authorization bill that would make permanent law increases in combat pay and family separation allowance. The administration has given us conflicting reports on where they stand, where you stand on this. At one time, they said in the statement of administration policy, they were opposed to these increases. Then they came back and said, no, we favor these increases. Now there's the third option. And the third option is to remove the increases in combat pay and the increases in family separation allowance, but to increase hardship pay only for those troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think this would be a serious mistake. It's my understanding that we have a proposal, and I'd like to ask the Secretary, that we remove the increases and go back to an increase in hardship pay, which is a discretionary increase. Mr. Secretary, which is it?
Well, it's true that we're extending the family separation and the imminent danger pay through the end of the year. At the end of the year, we go with the increase in the hardship, and that is, in fact, for Iraq and Afghanistan.
That was not actually Defense Secretary Rumsfeld responding. He apparently deferred to Dr. Zakim, the Defense Department comptroller. What are your positions on this, Representative Kaptur?
Well, first of all, I think that the administration is not totally organized internally in their approach to military requirements in this war. The Secretary was answering Senator Durbin's question on hazardous duty pay and separation pay, for example. We cannot get straight answers from the administration on such things as payment for meals. Soldiers are having to pay for meals. One of our people who came back to Walter Reed ended up with a bill of $500 and some for meals. We have a bill here in the House that would take away that cost to the soldier.
You're saying a soldier in the hospital is being forced to pay for his or her own meals?
Yes. Because they aren't in theater right now. So now we have a bill in the House to try to remediate that problem, all right? There are over 20,000 to 30,000 Guard and Reserve troops in Iraq right now, and I really believe they are being treated differently than active duty. And in terms of supplies, half the people in a number of these units didn't even have flak jackets that were appropriate. They didn't have basic supplies in their kits, whether it was first aid, whether it was personal toiletries that they needed.
And we're reading on the articles that are saying that they're likely to start calling up more of these reserves and the National Guardsmen because of the fact that no other nations have offered to send in troops.
I can tell you more units are being deployed from my district. I just wished off a reserve unit last week that's being sent to Afghanistan. And it was a terrible separation for the families, and we don't know how long they'll be gone. This is another thing. We can't get the information from the Department of Defense on rotation out dates. I have one guard unit over there that three times has had its hopes dashed as to when they were coming home. To me, it seems like the administration is flying by the seat of its pants, particularly with regard to how the members of our military, the patriots that are out there fighting this war for us, are being treated. And it makes me as an appropriator very uncomfortable, and it makes me doubt if they're not spending the dollars that are necessary with all we have given them. Where is the money going?
Congresswoman, what is your position with regard to the family separation pay and the combat pay being decreased, basically, or only being applied to those troops in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, obviously, I don't think that you build a military with that kind of policy. We have to think about the future. We have to think about enlistment down the road. And when you basically fuzz it up or you violate what is an expectation, that filters down through the ranks. And I can tell you this, that the Guard and Reserve in my state are deeply worried. Their recruitment levels are down now. I believe when people come home, they're going to get out because their expectations were dashed. And morale is a problem. I think that what you're speaking about there, people shouldn't be treated as second-class citizens. They're called up, they're active, whether they're guard, reserve, or active duty. They're in theater. They are prepared to serve their country, and they ought to be treated accordingly. I don't think there should be this kind of false separation because you never know where you're going to be.
And so if recruitment is down and it's your perception that people are likely to leave the service once they return home, where will that leave this country in terms of having enough troops to serve? Are we looking at possibly reinstituting the draft?
Well, I'll tell you, I think we are at that point right now because the Guard and Reserve units were never meant to be deployed for this length of time. They have always had the concept of weekend warriors. If we have floods in this country, if we have security needs in this country, after 9/11 they distinguished themselves. We have homeland needs as well, but they are literally being treated as active duty. But if you look at the way that the Department of Defense has treated our Guard and Reserve, they really are second-class citizens in this conflict. And I think the reason they're being deployed for such lengthy periods of time, and by the way, the Department of Defense has their dates of deployment all confused. I've had this happen with units in my state. They don't even know where some of them are. This is true, if you can believe this. I couldn't believe it until I got in the middle of it trying to figure out where some of our units were. It makes people lose confidence in the system.
U.S. Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, a Democrat from Ohio and a member of the House Foreign Relations and Appropriations Committee. We turn our attention now to the life of a fallen soldier in the battle for human rights. He was a scholar on the front lines of the intellectual fight for Palestinian rights, Columbia University professor Edward Said, who died last night after losing his recurring struggle with leukemia. Edward Said was a Palestinian. He spent much of his youth in Egypt and Lebanon, but had many relatives who were dislodged from Palestine as Israel came into being. He once wrote, "I have been moved to defend the refugees' plight precisely because I did not suffer and therefore feel obligated to relieve the sufferings of my people." He prompted a controversy in 2000 when he threw a rock toward an Israeli guardhouse on the Lebanese border. Columbia University did not censure him, saying that the stone was directed at no one, no law was broken, and that his actions were protected by principles of academic freedom.
History is made by men and women, and the world we live in is a secular and historical world as a result. History is therefore the product of human labor, choice, and will. Nothing transcendental or divine can supersede that truth or suspend the consequences that flow from its application. There simply is no convincing way to assert special claims whose origin is the divine. Claims that supposedly legitimate high altitude or smart bombing or the use of 60-ton bulldozers to demolish the houses of poor and defenseless people who don't happen to belong to the right religion or race. Just as I feel as an American that the United States has not been divinely endowed with a special errand into the wilderness and that its practices are endorsed by God, I feel it's my moral and intellectual duty to oppose the unjust use of its immense military, economic, and political power abroad for what is, it claims falsely, to be its national security interests. I have no power. So I must resort to the tools of education, to writing and speaking.
I'm Nasir Aruri, and I am Professor Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts. And I've known Edward Said since 1968. Edward Said's death is a huge loss. I mean, I would even say that he's irreplaceable. I mean, you know, nobody is irreplaceable, I suppose, but I think he's a loss to the Palestinian people, irrespective of ideological differences, even though he was a critic of the Oslo process. I think that even those defenders of it came to respect him. He's a critic to the literary community. I mean, after all, he was described by the New York Times as the foremost literary critic of the 20th century. Also, he'll be missed by the music community. He was an accomplished pianist. I mean, Edward Said was a Renaissance man. His seminal work, Orientalism, I think, had a great impact on the whole study of on what is called here as Middle East studies. And, you know, Middle East studies was not really his specialty, but it became one of his specialties because until Orientalism, I think that the whole field of Middle East studies was dominated by intellectuals and academics whom Edward Said came to call Orientalists, people who basically relied on describing the Third World, describing the Arab world and the Muslim world from the vantage point of the colonialists, not from that of somebody, you know, inside looking in, but from somebody outside really looking at the Middle East. And so I think that Orientalism had really a great impact on the whole study of, on the way we came to study the Middle East.
My name is Zainab Istrabadi. I'm the Associate Director of the Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies Program at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. And I worked for nearly 15 years for Professor Edward Said as part of his team running his office. I was his personal assistant. He was a man who had many interests. Certainly human rights was one of them. He is a Palestinian, but he believed in freedom and dignity for all peoples. I actually think that although he has had a tremendous influence, I rather suspect that his work will continue to have an influence for many years to come. In other words, there are still some undiscovered angles about him that will emerge in his work.
Ali Abu Nima, co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, I knew Edward Said as a friend and a teacher. I think it still hasn't sunk in yet that Edward Said is gone. He was a giant. He was an inspiration to me personally and to so many people. I think he will be remembered by many people in the Palestinian community as one of the most articulate advocates for justice for the Palestinians. But I think that his contribution is really much greater than that, because he was someone who searched to put that struggle in the context of a much greater struggle for a universalist, humanist vision of the world. And he worked for that relentlessly. He spoke truth to power. He was an incredible bridge between civilizations and between parts of the world that have a hard time listening to each other. He was a great interpreter of Arab and Muslim worlds for Americans, and at the same time he spoke to people in the Arab world, often fiercely critical of the status quo there and telling people things they didn't necessarily want to hear. And I think he was a rare Renaissance man who was relentlessly engaged with the world. He loved to be engaged in debates and ideas in creation.
This is Rabbi Michael Lerner, and I'm the editor of Tikkun magazine, bimonthly Jewish critique of politics, culture, and society. And I knew Edward as a colleague in the struggle to transform American society and to build society based on justice and peace. And I was particularly related to him in relationship to ending the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. I'm very sad that he died and feel that we've had a major loss for the forces of peace and justice in the world. Edward was an articulate and brilliant analyst of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza by Israel. He was an unrelenting critic of the way that the Israeli state supported that occupation, and also of the many distortions and lies in the United States government and United States policies in that area. Although at times he and I disagreed, and we had struggles in Tikkun magazine and in other venues and on the telephone. I also had enormous respect for him and a real sense that this was a man who was dedicated to peace and to justice and was an ally in the struggle that both Jews and Muslims and Christians have to end all forms of oppression in the world. Edward Said was someone who was not afraid to critique both the injustices of Western colonialism and imperialism and the distortions that generated in those who had been dominated. So that, for example, on the one hand, he was willing to very clearly and strongly force Americans and force Israelis and force Jews to recognize the injustices of the occupation. On the other hand, he was equally clear that the way that Arab states were behaving towards the Palestinian people was a disgrace, and that some of the activities and movements inside the Palestinian world were self-destructive and a manifestation of the way in which the distortions of the larger world had been internalized. There were very few people who were willing to stand up both to the occupiers on the one hand and to the distortions amongst the occupied on the other hand. And I think that the world is going to miss that voice.
This is David Barsamian, the director of Alternative Radio and author of a couple of books with Edward Said, The Pen and the Sword, and most recently, one that came out just a couple of months ago, Culture and Resistance. I've been working with Edward Said for almost 20 years. I've produced numerous programs of his lectures and his interviews for national and international broadcast. He's a Renaissance figure. It's hard to talk about him in the past tense because his work and his contribution have done so much to transform the cultural landscape and our understanding of the Middle East. And his two great works, Orientalism and Culture and Imperialism, stand as real bookends to his enormous contribution to not just scholarship, which of course it is, but also to gaining a greater understanding of the intersection of power and knowledge and how the role of intellectuals is so crucial in formulating alternatives to existing hegemonic dominant ideology. And Said, par excellence, was that. He was an activist scholar. He was someone who was engagé, you know, he was engaged. He was not just sitting in his rarefied ivory tower, but he was out in the streets with working with organizations, speaking all over the place, doing interviews. In addition to his enormous contribution in the cultural field, of course, he single-handedly has thrust the issue of Palestine into everyone's consciousness.
My name is Enes Shalal. I am an Arab-American, Iraqi-American peace activist. I mean, Edward Said, I remember, you know, first seeing him at an ADC convention, Arab-American Anti-Discrimination Committee convention. And I remember hearing these words that were like soothing to the soul, and you could see that somebody could put your thoughts in eloquent format and be able to recite them back in a meaningful way. It was just so important for us, especially Arab Americans and people that have been fighting, you know, all these important causes, like for the Palestinians and so on, to hear someone like an Edward Said and to realize that there's still some sanity in this world. There are still people that, you know, believe in justice and believe in the right way to do things. And be able to say it and do it so beautifully and so eloquently. So yeah, his lectures and his writings were invaluable to us in the peace movement.
My name is Simona Scioroni. I'm the executive director of the Peace and Justice Studies Association, that is a national association of educators, activists,
and it's based at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. I am an Israeli peace activist in solidarity with Palestinians for the past 2 decades, and I worked for 7 years in New York City in, you know, part of many of the networks that Edward Said has inspired. His philosophy and his ability to believe in the ability of people to transform and change, and the openness that he's had, and the ability to support Jews and Israeli Jews that understood that justice is indivisible, and that taking a stand on justice must include taking a strong position on injustice that is done to Palestinians. My hope is that if there are people out there that only enjoy this writing, that they now, as they mourn the loss, that they will be compelled to move into action, because he leaves a very big void. And those of us who've been maybe more humble, more in the background, have to step up and fill it, because the struggle continues. And, you know, the people of Palestine are in a very, very difficult place, whether they're in the West Bank and Gaza or whether they're refugees. So, you know, we can't afford to mourn for too long. We have to look at the lessons, and he would want us to continue.
But I want to argue that is not at all there is to the whole truth. There are other accomplishments and realities also to be noted with positive approbation and admiration. During my own lifetime, Palestinians, since the climactic events of 1948, when their society was destroyed and the establishment of Israel occurred, Palestinians have gone from the status of non-persons to that of a universally acknowledged national collectivity, i.e., a people, by virtue not of force of arms, but of other means, some of which I want to rehearse here. If for now Palestinians are still stateless, dispossessed, and for the most part exiled, it is because by those very unmilitary means, some of which are the mobilized force of memory, the power of images, and the heroism and ingenuity of sheer persistence, Palestinians embody perhaps the most visible and certainly the most universal case of human rights abuses on earth today. There's no desire on my part to be fetishistically competitive about such a claim, so I won't go on about it any further. But I do want to be able to talk about the visibility not only of the Palestinian presence as victims of injustice and human rights denial, but of the equal force they represent on the world stage of a wrong that must be righted.
Edward Said lost his final battle with leukemia and died last night in a New York hospital. He was 67 years old. His legacy will live for generations to come. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.